Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast. Let me turn to my guest, who is here with me this morning, back with me for our regular visit, which I appreciate very, very much. Paul Reed is here from Archaeology Southwest and Salmon Ruins. Paul, welcome back.
Good morning, Scott. Glad to be here.
Yeah, we have
2 months
here
in a row in person.
Right, in the flesh. There you are. Exactly. Good to see you. Things going well?
Yeah, yep. Good.
You told me you were planning to go out in the heat this afternoon, so have fun with that.
I am. Heading okay. Out to Chaco. So I'm ready for that fall weather. So
I bet.
I'll be waiting for next week.
No kidding. Because you still do a lot of field work in the summer, and that is tough duty sometimes, I guess, when it's 90 plus.
Yeah, my preference really is the fall. But, you know, with everything going on around Chaco and what we're going to talk about, you know, this morning, I needed to get out and look at some of these places. And yeah, so, but it's been a nice summer out there. Some thunder showers here and there.
That's
not
true.
Not as much as we want, but
yeah, you can always use more. That's true.
Right.
Very true. And that is the kind of focus of our topic this morning, and our talk is Chaco Canyon. And I know you are paying very close attention to some of these decisions and plans being produced by the Bureau of Land Management, and that's what brings you here this week, right?
Right, because we're approaching at the end of the month, the September 25th deadline for BLM and BIA's long-range plan for the area. So a lot of folks been concerned about this. We've been working on this for 7 calendar years. So we started in early 2014, and here we are in, you know, mid to late 2020.
And now this is the federal government. So is this normal for 7 years, or is this taking a long time, or is it a good thing, bad thing?
I think it's a little bit longer than is typical. But part of this, of course, is we had an administration change kind of midstream, and there was a direction that was being headed under the Obama administration. And, you know, we took kind of a U-turn, to be honest, under the current administration, and that cost some time.
I see.
So that happened in the summer of 2017. So we're at about 3 years since that sort of major shift happened. And we had worked 2014 to about 2016 with the prior administration. So, yeah, the politics sometimes influences where things go.
Gotcha.
Is about the nicest way to say it.
So nobody can be accused of rushing this thing through.
No,
this
has not been rushed through at all. Although there are some concerns at this point, because with, you know, the coronavirus disrupting things so heavily for now 6 months, and it looks to go through the end of the year with that disruption, you know, folks are concerned that, you know, with this long-term process that a lot of people have investment in, lots of stakeholders, that it is now hitting that stretch run, and instead of getting the proper public meetings in particular, that, you know, the circumstances have forced the agencies to go to these virtual meetings. And the participation in those has not been good. You know, they've had some folks call in and be able to offer comments and some video things going, but a large part of the people affected by this are out on the Navajo Nation, and there are Pueblo communities that have ancestral lands that we've talked about on the show. And those communities are still coping with COVID-19.
Well, how do they connect to a virtual meeting, right?
Yeah,
that's some of the issues.
They've got to go a lot of times to central locations, to their governments, and be able to participate. And of course, you know, as we know, the coverage for electricity, water, and internet is very, very spotty across the Navajo Nation. So I think a lot of the tribes feel like the federal government is just rolling forward with this and is really not hearing their concerns to slow this down and potentially stretch this into next year, when there might be time to get back to real meetings.
Right.
You know, at this point, the tribes have had, we had a couple of meetings early in the year in February and early March, and then COVID-19 shut all this down. So there's been none of the interaction that is really expected and required under the National Environmental Policy Act, that's NEPA, and some of the other federal laws. You know, the government has to go to a public place, make a presentation, and then say to people, we want to hear from you. And that's a super important process. This is how we do policy, environmental policy in the country. And to have to set that aside is just, you know, it's really devastating for the communities most affected.
Right. So talk to me a little bit about what the key points are of this document that is being worked on, right? This is, again, you mentioned with the BIA and the BLM, right? They're working together on this, which is another unique thing, right? This is the first time they've done that, isn't it?
Right, right. In my experience, it is. So we had a BLM process that ran, you know, again, started in early 2014 to about this time in 2016. And due to pressure from tribes and from some of the groups that I'm associated with, we got Interior to pull BIA into a joint process. Now, BIA doesn't do resource management plans, but they do environmental impact statements. So they're doing that kind of a document, and then BLM is doing both the resource management plan amendment and the EIS. So they're sort of working in tandem, a lot of cooperation, but they'll end up with two different documents that govern, you know, this almost 3 million acre area that they call the decision area. So, you know, and that's been great to have that cooperation back and forth between them, because it's a little bit ridiculous for BLM, who is the land manager for about 19% of these lands, to put forward a plan and not have BIA, who manages much more of that through the allotments and cooperation with Navajo Nation, to not have them involved. So that was an important step. At this point, though, what the agencies have released for alternatives, and that's part of this process they go through, are a range of alternatives. There's about 12 or 13 of them, and they're under letters A, B, C, and D, and some sub-alternatives. And most of those, the groups that I work with and the tribes are just not really happy with at this point. The one that the agency seemed to favor is alternative C, which would not really honor this 10-mile zone of protection that we've been talking about now for 3 or 4 years, you know, that passed the U.S. House last year and was in the Senate before COVID hit and a couple other things kind of stalled it. You know, so we basically don't have protection at this point for this zone, this 10-mile protective zone around Chaco. BLM's plan calls for what they term no surface occupancy in the closest area to Chaco, about 4 miles. That seems to be the alternative they prefer the most. But that allows leasing still within that zone and literally within sight of Chaco. So if you went to Chaco, you did the climb up on top to go up to Pueblo Alto, look at the North Road, you would be able to look out into the distance and see these rigs drilling on the lands that are outside the park boundary. And that's something that a lot of people are concerned about.
And a 10-mile zone would remove that possibility,
It would, just because of the topography. We'd get out to that 10-mile area, and that would no longer be visible from the park boundary. You know, and we've had a lot of debate on this, and I know different groups have weighed in, suggested smaller zones potentially. But if you tour Chaco from the air, and I've been fortunate to have support of a nonprofit, a guy named Bruce, who flies out of Aspen, Colorado, and has taken me up with Pueblo leaders, Navajo leaders at different points. If you fly south into Chaco down the rough route of the Great North Road that the Chacoans built, you know, in the 1000s, you really see the difference between sort of the industrial developed oil field from Farmington south. You get to about that 10-mile zone, and it really thins out tremendously. So when people have said, oh, you know, they set up a dartboard and they threw darts, right? And you got the 10-mile dart instead of the 5 or the 20. Well, at 10 miles, the area beyond that zone really does increase in the industrialization of that oil field. South of it, I describe it as a relatively pristine area. Certainly, folks live there. There's development. There's some older wells, older leasing activity. But we've been successful in the last 7 or 8 years in keeping new activity out of that zone. Those have been deferred. And it really is a different area than what we see just north of it. So it's not arbitrary. The other thing is, what work I've been doing this summer is looking at some of the communities, the ancient communities that exist within that, trying to create some larger maps and put things together so that we can really see how much of the area was utilized by people in the past. And it's a surprisingly large area. You know, it's localized, so you have a Chaco and Pueblo community here, and you might have some space, and then you've got another one. But there are about a dozen of these communities that exist within that zone around Chaco. So it's not just about we're going to put up a wall and not let development happen and exclude it. There are significant resources in that zone that require protection, and at this point are beyond, you know, the Park Service boundary. So they don't have the protections that we would like to see.
Right. And I know every time we talk about this, Paul Reed, I always like to remind our listeners and viewers that we're not talking about anything inside the boundaries of the Chaco Canyon Park.
Right.
That is always protected. That's not going to change. This is now a radius around the park, whether you're talking 10 miles or 4 miles or whatever the case may be. And so recently, as the BLM will put up leases and parcels for development, for leasing, for oil and gas development perhaps, but they have deferred at least for the moment, right, anything inside this 10-mile boundary just by practice. Is that what they've done?
Right. There have been a number of different things. You know, when some leases have come up, they're supposed to do these every quarter, and it depends on how that works. But there were leases that were put forward in March 2018 that were well within that 10-mile. There was a large public outcry, a lot of different interest groups, constituencies, not just us preservation types. You know, the tribes were very concerned. Other groups were. So they pulled those back. And they didn't lease them. You know, then there's other parcels that have come up where they're doing maybe 50 parcels. People are concerned about the ones closer to Chaco, so they'll remove 10 and move forward with another package. So, yeah, they've been responsive to that. And then, of course, you know, as we've talked about on the show, Secretary of the Interior Bernhardt went to Chaco last summer in 2019 and made an agreement that we never saw any paperwork on, but ultimately was honored, where they didn't lease in Chaco for a year. So he put a moratorium in place.
And that's in that 10-mile zone? Is that
right,
what we're talking
specifically
about?
Specifically in the 10-mile.
Okay.
And that was to allow things to move forward. I think his expectation at that point is that the documents we're talking about now would probably be finalized and there would be a clear direction. So that got pushed a little further. But, you know, that agreement was honored and they didn't do any additional leasing. And at this point, they don't have any leases that were offered in September and they don't look to be doing it in December as well. You know, what happens next year, of course, is, you know, really hard to predict.
Well, after this year, all bets are off. What's going to happen
with COVID-19 and, yeah, the election in a couple months? You know,
right.
It's hard to predict. But at this point, we're not going to see any new leasing that happens. So that's good, because then this plan can hopefully go through a process. The concern we have is that one of the other big developments in 2019 is the Department of Interior got a big appropriation, $1 million, to do a cultural study around Chaco. Now, this wasn't focused on, you know, sort of white man's style archaeology that we've been doing for years and that tribes have had concerns about and have asked us to expand. This was money through BIA to go to concerned tribes. So Navajo Nation, all the Pueblos, other groups, you know, Hickory, Apache, others that might be concerned could then put proposals in and apply to this, you know, this bank of $1 million and complete their own studies. So, of course, they were meeting on this, and, you know, I maintain good contacts with folks, and they had met several times. COVID-19 comes along, and so a lot of that ground to a halt. I understand they're still working towards getting some of that completed.
I see.
Because the idea was to get those contracts out and to have groups be able to start work this fall. And whether that's going to happen with COVID-19 is really unclear. The concerns that we've had is, you know, we were thrilled that money came through, and this was Senators Udall and Heinrich really pushing that, as well as Ben Ray Lujan in the House helping to support that. But this plan goes forward, and they want to finalize the documents for these plans before we have the results of that cultural study. So there's concern there, unless the document that's finalized leaves what the agencies describe as decision space, so that if, you know, tribes find significant resources, that then the agencies can come back and say, well, we're not going to lease here because there are concerns that archaeologists have worked out here for decades, but they aren't, you know, we're not trained to identify the resources that are specifically important to a lot of the tribes. There's overlap between archaeological sites, cultural sites, and what, you know, we could call traditional cultural places, TCPs, or sacred sites. But in working with ACIMA a couple of years ago, I learned that many of the sites that archaeologists identify, you know, that tribal members will recognize, but there's a whole nother class of things out on the landscape that we're not trained to recognize. And that's really what's been missing in some of this cultural resource work.
So if we get these studies in from the tribes and the Pueblos that are kind of linked to Chaco Canyon, that would be a good voice to hear moving forward.
It's a critical voice to hear from my perspective, and I think from a lot of the perspectives of folks that we've been working with, because this we're missing a big part of this equation.
Right.
We have physical remains on the ground that can be identified through an archaeological process, but we have other important sites out there that, you know, people have just not been recognizing. And so what's happened is, you know, we've done different visits. Tribes have gone back into areas after development has happened, and they'll point out resources that have been impacted. And at that point, we're not able to do anything about it.
Right.
So the concern is to protect those places, you know, with a well thought out plan. And then by the time the agencies get to leasing, be able to say, even if an oil company nominates a parcel, they go through the information they have and the recent work of the tribes and say, we have to exclude this area because this has been identified as a sensitive area, and we want to protect the resources in there. You know, and this is less about, oh, we want to restrict development and shut it off. It's like, no, we need to understand what the important resources are for tribes and to go through the processes outlined in federal law to protect those places. And because we haven't done the level of ethnographic work, you know, cultural work with the tribes and getting tribal members out on these landscapes, we simply don't know what's out there. We don't know enough.
This would help. This will help answer that question.
This will help tremendously. And again, the concern is to finish a plan amendment and an environmental impact statement before we have this information. So those things are kind of running counter to each other.
Right. And that's the thing we started talking about, right? The deadline is coming up end of September.
Right. That's for comments. And then I think the agencies want to finish what's called their Record of Decision or ROD before the end of this calendar year. They won't have those results from the tribes. So there needs to be some kind of a provision made, again, that decision space or whatever it's going to be called, to allow input from the tribes on what gets leased. And, you know, right. We might be able to catch some of this at the leasing stage, but the concern is that a plan gets put in place that then could be implemented and wouldn't really take into account these other concerns.
Understood. So when I said this wasn't rushed through, the idea is, no, it wasn't, but still now at this point, longer time may be better to get some of these other voices
in. Longer time
in.
Could be better. And, you know, we've been talking about this, about having tribes do more ethnographic work, any ethnographic work out there, since 2015. So it's not like we were sitting around and then all of a sudden, you know, this money was appropriated at the last minute, and now we're wanting to delay it just so we can delay it. We've been putting the word in. And, you know, and BLM, to their credit, got a different piece of money, and that was made available in 2018 to do another type of study. And so they've been trying to pursue that. But some of the setup there, because it wasn't necessarily tuned towards what the tribes wanted, that project hasn't panned out in quite the way that others had hoped.
Right.
So, you know, these things take time. Ideally, money would have been appropriated in 2014 or 15 or 16, big sums of money, because you can't go out and just do this work on a scale of a few weeks and then end up with a several hundred page report, you know, that's going to have a lot of good information. That's a process that takes time.
Right. So, is this money that's been appropriated now sufficient to at least get started or get some documentation?
I think it is. And of course, $1 million sounds like a lot of money. The thing is, the Navajo Nation is a very large organization, big tribe. You know, they have studies they would like to complete. And we have 19 New Mexico Pueblos. We have Jicarilla. Right. We have Ute Mountain Ute, potentially, you know, and other groups. But those are the ones who would be most interested. So if you divide $1 million by 20, right, it's 50,000. So
now you're
talking about something on the scale of what we did with ACOMA, with money raised through different groups, you know, no public money in that, private donations, you know, and we were able to learn certain things. But once you divvy that money out, it doesn't go quite as far.
Sure. No,
as
that's true.
Might be hoped.
Right.
But it would be, it is an important beginning to understanding this process. And if there were, you know, good indications that this area or that area was more sensitive than over here, then that gives us some of the tools, and it would give the agencies the tools to maybe say, okay, we're not going to lease here until we complete some more detailed work and get, you know, and maybe BLM hires, you know, some tribal members to go out and work for them and do this. They did that. They used to do that and hire more folks in the old days. And then we've kind of had the changes in budgets and federal money. And it's easier at this point for them to hire contractors to do certain things. But there's avenues,
right,
is the point. There's options for getting this work done, as long as the plan that gets put in place has some flexibility. So that's something we're very concerned about.
Understood. My guest this morning, archaeologist Paul Reed, is here. He works with Archaeology Southwest and Selman Ruins. We were talking about Chaco Canyon and this document that the BLM is putting forward with the BIA. And so let me play devil's advocate for just a moment here. And let's say that this document is accepted at the end of September, moves on to the next stage. It's this alternative C?
D is the one. Yeah, D is the
4-mile.
I'm sorry, D is the one we, B is the one we like. They like C.
Okay,
but anyway,
there you
go.
All right. So instead of a 10-mile radius of protection around Chaco Canyon, it's going to be a 4-mile radius around Chaco Canyon. Is it conceivable then that if this 4-mile goes into effect and somebody wants to lease something from between mile 5 and 10, that they remove that again like they have been doing over the past few years?
It certainly is, because, you know, we have sort of these different levels to it. The resource management plans and the EISs are the top. of the banner, if we want to think right. of it that way. Leasing is kind of the mid-range, and then when they actually go out and stake individual well locations and pipelines and roads, that's what we call, you know, the APD or approval to drill stage. So at that point, they pretty much know what they want to do. Some adjustments can be made. So the decision making is more critical at the plan stage to say, here's what's going to be allowed. And then when actual leases get identified and we draw boxes or circles, here's a spot we want to lease. So the concern is that the plan puts some of that protection in place. Now, if a 4 mile zone was excluded, people could lease, you know, starting at just past 4 miles, those could be proposed. And people might say, well, we have concerns because of the work that's been done by the archaeologists or some of the newer tribal cultural work says we don't want them to lease here. We could raise objections, but with this plan in place, they would be able to go ahead and lease those potentially. So there wouldn't be the force of law that having a 10-mile zone in place in the plan or something going through the Congress, of course, and getting signed into law.
Sure.
That would be, you know, a different level.
But there's no guarantees that I guess the BLM would do that either to remove some of these things from even being leased in the first place.
Right, right. They would have to go through the process that we call Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation Act and try to avoid impacting specific resources on the ground. But the concern we have is that, you know, an intrusion into an area that a tribe has said is important and needs to be set aside would result in a certain amount of, you know, despoilment or, you know, would impact that landscape.
Right.
And then the tribes might not be able to use that in a way they have traditionally.
And so, pardon me for interrupting,
sure.
but by going then with this other alternative with the 10-mile radius, that
right.
then leads everyone to have a sigh of relief that they're worried about protecting this space and not have to fight every time a new lease is proposed or what
right.
have you. It's
That's
permanently
right.
protected. Is that the idea?
It would be, at least for the life of the plan, and in the absence of the federal legislation, that would be great. If we got the federal legislation, then that would be in place.
So not relying on the whim of the organization to remove these things from
right.
the purchase or the leasing.
Exactly,
right?
Because it's up to whoever the director is at the district in Farmington here and the state director for BLM. Those decisions get made. And if a company really leans on different organizations and they want to get a lease, then that can be hard to stop if that isn't in the plan. So that's the concern we have. And folks have worked so long on this at this point that it would be nice to just have this set aside. The other reality, you know, and this is something that would, you know, might be worthy of getting some industry reps in to talk about. The Mancos Shale, as I've heard about it talked by industry, as you go south towards Chaco, it becomes harder to extract. It's got a lot of water in it. So it's not that great of a place to look for that anyway and to try and, you know, get oil out of the Mancos Shale.
Right.
So it's better to the north.
Right.
And not so much around Chaco.
Sure. But still, we know that these oil and gas companies spend a lot of money on geologists to look into this and
right.
figure out where the best spot is to
right.
to invest in a drilling rig and to bring back that investment, I guess. And so there probably are some pockets in and around this zone we're talking about that could be lucrative for investment.
It's possible. Although, you know, with the
right now,
boom
there's
we
not
had,
a lot of there's not a drilling
well,
going on anyway.
Right now, with oil at $41 a barrel or whatever, it's definitely not profitable. But when we had the mini boom, they weren't pushing for leases close to Chaco. So that makes me wonder about it, Scott.
Right.
I mean, ultimately, if the price of oil went high enough, there'd be a lot of areas that could be. We could try and extract those resources. But, you know, we're also making a transition towards a greener economy. You know, our state has made a commitment to that. And, you know, so some of this could conceivably never come to market and not be profitable. And
right.
that would ultimately protect some of the places we're concerned about, the tribes are concerned about, people living on the ground, you know, and just the overall environment.
But we're not talking about making a plan for the next 6 months. This would be something on the books for until the next plan comes around.
Right,
could
10,
be what?
15, 20 years.
Okay.
These are long-range plans.
And the price of oil during that time could go, who knows where it's going to go, up
we
or
have,
down.
Right, we have no idea. And that's why so many folks are concerned to get a good plan in place, because it is going to guide what happens for oil and gas development for a long time.
Right. Let me ask you a bit. I know the Navajo Nation has certainly chimed in on this. They have a vested interest in determining what's going on. There are some folks that live around that Chaco Canyon area in this zone that we're talking about, right, that
right.
rely on maybe some royalty payments or some grazing permits and things like that. And so the tribe kind of tries to weigh all those things, too, when it decides on what to support and maybe what to propose, correct?
Right, exactly. Exactly. And then, you know, as a sovereign Indian Native American nation, they have their own concerns and those should be heard. One of the bits of misinformation that went out in the discussion was that the federal legislation with the 10-mile protective zone would prohibit all development inside that on all lands. And this is absolutely not true. It is limited to federal surface lands and it only relates to the oil and gas. So if folks have allotments, they would still be free to contract, have agreements with oil companies to do drilling on their own lands. So it's a very,
even within that zone.
Even within that zone. Okay. So it's a real targeted piece of legislation that's designed to remove the BLM, you know, surface about 20% from it, and just to protect those lands. So the tribe would still have full sovereignty over their lands. Individual allotment owners could still come to their own agreements. So some of the information that went out, I think, has just been wrong, you know. And there's
I'm shocked that right? there'll be misinformation out in the public.
It's hard. Oh, yeah. It's, you know, but for those of us who care about one issue or another, we try to, you know, we talk about it a lot and try and say, well, here's what this would do, here's what it would not do. Right. But of course, it's hard to blame the tribes at times because the government hasn't always been straightforward with them. And people have some concerns about that.
The federal government and the state governments.
Okay. But as proposed, this is, you know, it's exactly what I've said. The tribal lands are not affected.
But the Navajo Nation government did come on the record, didn't they? And they didn't support the 10-mile. Right. They're more in favor of, was it the 4-mile?
Right, 5 miles.
The 5 miles.
They had moved forward, and I think that was partly related to the misinformation that was out there. And hearing from
their constituents, I suppose, if they were going off of that wrong information.
Yeah, I don't want to be barred from doing things on my own land, and this wouldn't do that at all. So, you know, and the 10-mile really wouldn't infringe at all on Navajo tribal sovereignty. You know, that's an important statement to make as well. And this is off-reservation, so it bounds the reservation on the Navajo Nation, and within the boundaries, the tribe absolutely makes their own decisions about it. So this is outside in the checkerboard that grew out of the historical, this group's here, that group's there, and
all that
stuff. It makes all this land management stuff very, very complicated, because we also have, you know, between 5 and 6% that's state land.
Right.
That's another
whole other people dealing with that, right?
And then just other private. So, yeah. So that's what makes this super complicated. But, you know, and that probably is why this has taken years to get to this point.
But sure. But here we are.
Here we are.
And so, again, we have this September 25th deadline looming that may or may not get extended. And if folks really care about this, they should be paying attention.
They should. And if folks are concerned, then get your requests in to our state director in Santa Fe at the BLM and request that this deadline get extended again. You know, I personally doubt that they would extend it again because they seem really intent on getting this through. But again, we haven't had any of the public meetings required under NEPA. We've had limited participation in the virtual meetings. And I don't think, you know, especially most of the tribal folks have felt like they've had the opportunity to express themselves and be heard on it.
Right.
And that's an important part of our environmental process in the country.
Very true. Well, and getting that input from the public and from the folks that this could impact, like the folks living near there, as you mentioned, the tribal entities, the Pueblo entities, all these folks that deserve a seat at the table, even if it's a virtual table.
Right.
So there you go. Paul, we're almost out of time, but before we go, I want to put a plug in to remind everybody this week, of course, new state health orders were proposed and announced, and one of the things is that museums have been able to reopen, and that would include a place that's near and dear to your heart, I know, which is Salmon Ruins.
Right.
And they reopened, I believe, on Monday.
Right.
And the museum's open now. The ruins are open. You have to enter through the museum, of course, but again, it's a great gem in San Juan County. If folks haven't been out there, I would encourage folks to go and check it out. If you're looking for something to do this weekend, that you'd be socially distant and safe, but still check it out.
Right, exactly. Director out there, Larry Baker, wants everyone to come back. And they're also doing Chaco tours. So if folks are interested in going out to Chaco with an expert on the area, they're doing those. So just give them a call.
Very good. And I imagine Chaco's pretty empty these days.
It is.
Because of everything that's going on. So
yeah, the campground's still closed, but some folks going down there. So yeah, if you want to go spend some quality time in Chaco and, you know, come to a different understanding, do some hiking. It's a little warm still, but September and October are some of the best times to go.
Right.
So I would encourage that.
Yeah, and I would say too, if you go, take a look around that landscape, even as you get close to the park, that 10 miles out, and see what we're talking about. and and maybe really actually, I know it's hard to do it from the ground. You mentioned from the air, it's a greater visual experience, but certainly people can drive through that zone we're talking about and at least kind of see what we're talking about a little bit.
Right, and you get a sense of sort of Chaco's isolation, and I think it really does get you in the frame of mind to appreciate, you know, just how special a place Chaco was to the folks who lived there and to the descendants today and to many of the rest of us.
Right, and maybe how different that view would be if there was a drilling rig on the horizon.
Right.
Perhaps so. All right. Paul, thanks for coming in.
Scott, my pleasure as always. Thank
always
you.
Great to see you. You bet. We'll see you next month. Paul Reed from Archaeology Southwest and Salmon Ruins, my guest here on KSJE. I'll be back with more in just a moment, everybody. The time right now is coming up on 8:42. Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.